Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock. Welcome to Wireless, a series all about radio, broadcast on the first Monday of every month on Flirt FM 101.3 in Galway and on flirtfm.ie. I'm John Walsh and I'll be with you for the next hour. Wireless covers all aspects of radio, analogue and digital broadcasting, community, regional and national broadcasters, niche broadcasting, pirate and alternative radio, radio ownership and radio's history and future prospects. Coming up on this edition of Wireless on Flirt FM, we hear from Richard Logue in London, who's involved in the campaign to save RTE's longwave transmitter on 252 kHz. Dr. Andrew O'Buil of NUI Galway tells us about how the Trump presidency is a threat to community radio in the US. And Martina O'Brien discusses the work of CRAIL, the Community Radio Forum of Ireland.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
But first to Radio Retro, which each month delves into the archives to unearth a gem from radio history. Over the last few months, we've featured some of the pirate radio stations of the 1980s, mostly those based in Dublin. But there were pirates all over Ireland during that decade, including several in Galway, ranging from the commercial station Coast 103 to the much less predictable radio Pirate Woman, which was run by the activist Margaretta Darcy. One station with designs on the Galway market was Radio West, which broadcast from Mullingar and covered the Midlands initially. By the end of 1988, the station had installed a series of transmitters from Dublin to Galway and was audacious enough to call itself West National Radio 3. This promo was aimed at advertisers in the Galway area.
And that's the news this hour. We'll update it at 3 o'clock.
WESP. They're listening in Loughrea and Galway and Gort. They're tuned in Tuam and Craughwell and Aircourt and Ballinasloe, Athenry, Oranmore, Portumna, Moycullen, Glenamaddy and Dunmore. Fact is, when it comes to the county of Galway, West National Radio 3 leads the field. And that's great news if you're in business in the West. Every single one of over 2,000 square miles and thousands of pairs of ears listening to your message, day or night. If you want to talk to Galway, talk to Radio West Sales on 57459. That's Galway 57459. Because advertising on Radio West works. You're listening to...
Well, someone should have told him how to pronounce Craughwell. Along with other pirates, Radio West closed down at the end of 1988, but clearly didn't copyright the name, because the first legal local station in Galway, set up in 1989, was also called Radio West, and that of course changed its name to Galway Bay FM in the early 1990s. Many thanks to Brian Green in Dublin for that recording. And if you'd like to send us an archive recording for Radio Retro, feel free to get in touch through social media or on our blog, wirelessflirt.wordpress.com.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
In the Shannon last week, the independent Senator Billy Lawless called on RTE to maintain its long-wave radio service so that the Irish in Britain can continue to have access to RTE Radio 1 on an analogue platform. The long-wave transmitter, which is based in Clarkstown in County Meath, is threatened with closure this year, probably on the 1st of May. RTE claims that it costs €250,000 a year to run the Clarkstown facility, that listenership on longwave is negligible, and that those wishing to listen to Radio 1 outside the state can continue to do so online. 252 kHz was threatened with closure in 2014, but a campaign group, Save RTE Longwave 252, led to a postponement. The group was set up by former RTE engineer Enda O'Kane and representatives of the Irish community in Britain, and continues to lobby for a continuation of the service, with additional events planned with the diaspora between now and St Patrick's Day. Last year, a survey of over 3,000 Irish people in Britain by Middlesex University found that large majorities of respondents believed that the longwave service was a lifeline to Ireland and preferred it to digital or online platforms. I spoke to Richard Logue in London, a representative of Save RTE Longwave 252, and asked him first to explain the background to the campaign.
Back in 2008, RTE shut down their long-established medium-wave transmissions from Tullamore. And at that time, RTE had said that because they have transmissions going out on long wave, which pretty much duplicate what the medium wave transmissions had, they felt it was actually more value to them and certainly to their listeners to keep long wave and end the medium wave transmissions. And in fact, back in 2008, John Paul Coakley, who's head of operations of RTE Radio, had actually written an article in the Irish News in which he assured people in Northern Ireland that certainly long wave transmissions would continue, and that under the obligations for RTE for the Broadcasting Acts, that they felt that long wave was the better option for RTE on the AM bands.
And if this is the case, how then has it come to pass that long wave 252 is threatened with closure?
Well, it was threatened with closure. In fact, they made an announcement very, very quickly in October of 2014, and they basically gave the service about 3 weeks before they were going to close it. And they talked about the expense of transmission. It costs approximately €250,000 per year to transmit RT Radio 1 on long wave, and they felt that they could switch listeners to digital, whatever that meant at the time. And when RTE were pushed as to what they meant by digital, they basically said, well, we're already on satellite, we're already on the internet, you can shift to that. Now, that's fine up to a point, but the problem is with internet and satellite radio. Internet, for instance, isn't free radio as we know it. If you're on a mobile phone contract, typically a lot of people will have either a cap or a certain amount of data that they're allowed to download on a monthly basis before charges go ramping up. And if you're on an unlimited cap on the internet on your mobile phone, you'll find that you're often paying a premium for that service. So an awful lot of the people who would have been using RT Radio 1 initially from medium wave and then more recent years in long wave typically would have been a lot of elderly people, but also people who want to listen to RT Radio 1 in their cars. And whatever way you cut it, internet radio is still not at the point where you can get reliable in-car reception. But also the whole issue of actually caps and the cost of downloading data to the end user means that there isn't really an incentive for the casual listener to just regard internet radio as something they can flip on and flip off and not worry about the incoming costs of having to manage that.
And what about DAB? DAB is pretty well developed in the UK. There's quite a high level of DAB listenership, an awful lot more than in this country. Could RTE not simply be made available on DAB and most people then would be able to access it?
I think it would be a great idea if RTE were available in DAB, but the problem is that if RTE were to go on DAB in the UK, they'd have to come under the stewardship of Ofcom, who are the equivalent of Comreg in the UK. Now, we know that RTE have tried to set up a temporary DAB service in Manchester, but they've been trying to do this for about the last year, and up till now, I understand that there have been regulatory issues with Ofcom in the UK in order to get RTE Radio 1 transmitting. Now, there has been past run-ins between RTE and Ofcom, because back in the day when RTE Radio 1 was on 567 kilohertz and medium wave, there was a pirate station called Laser, which was on 558 in the southeast of England. So RTE lobbied very hard to get Laser off that frequency, and as soon as they were taken off the frequency, the predecessor to Ofcom, the Radio Authority, licensed a powerful AM local radio station in the London area on the 558 frequency. So Tullamore remained blocked out ever since in London. And the other issue is, as well as an issue, I would say, of sovereignty, because with the long-wave frequencies, RTE are only answerable to Comreg, whereas if they go on to DAB in the UK, they'd have to come under regulation of Ofcom as well. And seems to me, at least, that if you're in charge of an Irish radio station, you want to be answerable to your own rather than having to go cap in hand to an overseas administration.
Yes, but what about the arguments about long wave and the, you know, poor quality sound, that this really is a platform of the past, that it's subject to a lot of interference? I mean, all you need to do is plug in a hairdryer and you can hear your long wave signal being disrupted. So what about those arguments, that really this technology is old hat at this stage and we should be moving on?
I can understand why people say that, but actually the AM broadcast bands, and in particular long wave, actually is basically able to send its signal in a far longer distance than FM or DAB radio. And a lot of it depends on the strength of the signal. So, for instance, where I live in North London, we've got a very strong Radio 5 Live signal on medium wave, and nothing can interfere with that. Hair dryers, car ignitions, nothing. The other issue is that RTE have been gradually killing off the 252 frequency by the death of 1,000 cuts because the power of the signal has been reduced significantly. I believe it's under half of what they're actually normally transmitting it at the moment, even in the daytime. So obviously, if you've got a weaker signal, then yes, they are subject to interference. But when you've got a strong signal, that doesn't really matter. Now, back in the day when Atlantic 252 were on the air on 252, it was a thunderous signal. They broadcast at the full strength of 500 kilowatts, and there was very little interference. In fact, where I live in North London, Atlantic was a lot more powerful and long wave than BBC Radio 4.
So the question is not really one of interference. It's a question of reduced power by RTE on 252, which presumably is in preparation for close down?
I would have thought so, because I know from the results of the survey that was undertaken by the Department of Foreign Affairs that listeners at the Luton Irish Centre said that they hadn't been able to listen to RT Radio 1 for some time because the signal was so weak. Of course, you've got the other issue as well, is that on the same 252 frequency, you've got a very powerful radio station in Algeria, which has increased its power significantly in recent years. And that blots out RT Radio 1 over a large part of southern England now, even in the daytime, and I understand from people even in Ireland at night it often interferes as well.
Yes, also in Galway we have interference from Algeria at night, that is the case. And so I understand that you have been making some attempt to possibly propose a change of frequency to 261 kilohertz, the next available channel.
That's correct, John. So basically, the long wave bands are pretty open compared to the medium wave bands, and 261 has been vacant for some years now. And there is no sign at the moment of any further stations wanting to operate. Now, the reason we would like to see RT Radio 1 move to 261 is that it would be relatively little adjustment in the transmitter, and certainly on the transmitting aerial site, but it's a clear channel. Now, if RTE were then broadcasting at their full power of 500 kilowatts, they could practically send RT Radio 1 right down to the Alps on that signal, and it wouldn't be interfering with anybody else. You know, on that kind of strength, you'd have a totally clear and uninterfered signal, and it would be potentially able to carry right down as far as the Swiss Alps. So that would be covering a large chunk of Europe. I certainly think in these times of Brexit, it really is in Ireland's interests to be able to have our own national radio station readily available so we can hear an Irish perspective on what's happening, and also for the many thousands of Irish living over here in Britain, and of course increasingly large numbers in continental Europe as well.
So what difference has this made on a daily basis then to listenership of RTE Radio 1 on analogue services in the UK and on longwave in the UK? You mentioned the report by Professor Louise Ryan and others, an analysis of longwave radio in Britain. So
yes,
maybe you could talk to us a little bit about that report now.
I certainly will. So basically what happened was that they undertook a survey on behalf of the Department of Foreign Affairs, which was really, I suppose, in reaction to the very strong words of condemnation that came out of the Irish community here in Britain. But basically, what they found in the survey was that the bulk of listeners very much valued the fact that RT Radio 1 was available on a conventional radio, and significant numbers were saying that they listened to it quite regularly in the car. Now, if you go down the route of internet only and satellite, you can completely eliminate car radio listenership because it stops becoming a easy option in the car. Now, at the same time, people were basically saying they would listen, you know, a good 44% of the respondents said we usually listen to it in the car. So that's a pretty big audience. And the type of people, you know, radios, you know, devices that people were using were primarily either portable radios, car radios, or kitchen radios. Very few were actually listening on computers or on a mobile phone device.
But I suppose the point that RTE would make would be that people could listen on their computers, and indeed most people in the survey, despite their age, many of them were elderly, most people in the survey reported having a computer.
Indeed, but as I mentioned earlier, with the whole issue of data caps, where a lot of people have for the internet access, you know, listening to radio for, say, let's say, I typically would listen to Morning Ireland in the morning for an hour and a half, and I might listen to Late Date then at around about 11 or 12 o'clock at night in bed, and that's 2.5 hours of listening. That's a significant chunk of data that you're actually downloading. And if you're on a capped internet provider, then you're going to end up spending a lot of money just to listen to radio.
Can you tell us about some of the other findings of the report then that were important from the point of view of the Save RTE 252 campaign?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it was showed that the bulk of the listenership were in the sort of the older age bracket, and they were people who were primarily interested in listening, as I say, on conventional radios or in their car. But it also showed that there was, if you look at the kind of proportion, I believe there was something like about 3,500 people responded to the survey. Now, in terms of samples of audience, that's actually quite a large sample of people who selected to get involved in the actual survey itself. So any claims that RTE have made that the long-wave listenership in Britain was tiny, I don't really think stack up in terms of what's actually been said in that report.
Can we look a little bit then, Richard, at some of the technical aspects in terms of AM broadcasting in general? Because I suppose this raises bigger questions. I mean, we had in the last month or two FM being turned off in Norway, but many countries have now moved away from AM, and AM is very much viewed as a historical platform that maybe doesn't have a future. What are your views on those arguments?
Well, I don't necessarily buy those arguments about the historical platform. I mean, remember I said earlier that the AM broadcast bands actually have very different characteristics to, say, FM or DAB. So, in a nutshell, an AM transmission, the medium wave and long wave, can go several hundred miles with a single transmitter. Now, we know that TDF in France, who are the operators of the French broadcast network, have actually done some very, very interesting research into how to actually marry up AM broadcast bands with into Android tablets and smartphones. Now, this means that you can actually pass on data. Now, you've also got the development of DRM digital radio, which is essentially digital radio on the AM broadcast bands. And between all of that, I think AM broadcasting actually has a far brighter future than a lot of these so-called experts actually often say, because you've actually got the capability of sending signals directly into up-to-date devices. Now, India, for instance, which is very much now a very key radio market, in India there's been a very big push to digital radio on the AM broadcast bands. And I would say in another 5 to 10 years, I think you could actually see a resurgence of AM broadcasting, because at the end of it, it's a lot more efficient for a broadcaster to own one site rather than having to do multiple sites.
Despite the evidence then that DAB has been quite heavily invested in Europe, you don't think that DAB is the future of radio broadcasting?
I think DAB does have a future in radio broadcasting, but I think the fact that AM broadcast bands are able to send signals very long distances from a single site, I think that ultimately there will be a move back towards that, especially once the DRM broadcast method is actually perfected, because what you effectively have then is a sort of the ability to send signals very long distance just by using a very small number of transmitters. So I wouldn't rule anything out. I mean, DAB, I think, may ultimately take over from FM as a sort of a local broadcast system, but I still think there's going to be a need in future years for countries to be able to send either to their diaspora or out to other countries as sort of the whole need for broadcast over long distances.
So can we look a little bit then at medium wave versus long wave? Because long wave is perhaps the poor cousin in this case, even if you look at the average radio that you'd buy in a electronics store. Most radios will have medium wave, but not every radio will have long wave. And the same applies in cars, that most car radios will have medium wave at FM, for instance, but not long wave. So was the decision perhaps to close the Tullamore transmitter on medium wave in 2008, was that really the biggest mistake that RTE has made in your view?
I think it's a significant mistake. I mean, from my personal point of view here in Northwest London, I wasn't able to receive 567 because of the Spectrum radio station on 558, but it did provide coverage easily into Northern Ireland, and it did provide coverage into the UK Midlands and the north of England and right into Scotland. That to me seems to me a pretty short-sighted view in terms of getting rid of the actual service. But as I say, the long wave still has the advantage of longer distance propagation over medium wave signals as well.
So would you be happy then with a restoration to full power of the long wave signal and a move to 261? Would that in your mind be a success of your campaign?
It would be. I mean, certainly moving the signal to 261 would resolve the issues of interference from Algeria, and it would give RTE the opportunity to expand their audience most significantly. I mean, don't forget, they've never sold advertising either out into overseas markets, and there has been a fairly significant listenership to RTE Radio 1 up until recent years. So I think if RTE were able to keep the long wave service but move it, as I say, onto the clear channel of 261, which is just up the dial slightly from 252, it would give them the opportunity to actually have their service available to a far wider audience than at present.
Can we look a little bit at the campaign? Because you've been very much involved mobilising on the ground with other representatives of Irish groups in Britain and so on and so forth. So why does this issue matter so much to the Irish diaspora, do you think?
I think it matters because we want to keep in touch with what's going on at home. And, you know, RT Radio 1 has been available to a great deal of the Irish abroad ever since 1926. I mean, as early as 1926, people were picking it up in Birmingham. So it's been an absolutely important part of Irish people's lives. I have to say that, you know, RT Radio 1, and I've travelled extensively around the world, is probably one of the finest radio stations out there. They really do have a very high quality threshold for their programming. But there's also a lot of very dedicated people here in Britain working amongst the Irish diaspora, and I have to particularly mention people like Myra Butler in Manchester, Deirdre Quill in Leeds, Noreen Bowden, and also Michael Burke, Irish in Britain, and Jenny McShannon, who's the former chief executive of Irish in Britain. They've been very active in getting local communities aware and the need to get back in touch with the Department of Foreign Affairs and RTE to show that people value and this is our radio station. It isn't just this radio station on the island of Ireland. You know, this is, you know, very much an intrinsic part of what we are and how we can listen to Gaelic games, listen to music, listen to chat, Joe Duffy, Maren Finucane, and all of that. It's such an intrinsic part of being Irish that you can't imagine your life without it, quite frankly.
And what are your plans for the remainder of the campaign?
So what we're looking at now, we're awaiting to find out what the results of the Department of Foreign Affairs committee are. They've basically, on the back of the survey, have formed a committee of representatives of the Irish community plus RTE plus the department, and we understand they're coming back to report as to what their chosen option is on that. So we're going to keep, you know, visibility of the campaign alive. We've had a lot of backing from very senior people like Conor McGinn MP, who would be a leading member of the Irish community, who's a member of Parliament here in Britain. We've had great support from people like Father Brian Darcy, Dunnock O'Dooling, people who know the value that Irish radio is to people. And we will just keep on pushing and hoping that the powers that be in Dublin realise that, yes, we are out there and we do value our link with home.
What about the argument that RTE would undoubtedly make that this is costing them a quarter of a million of euros per year and that they're operating in a restricted budgetary situation and that really they need to spend this money on something more important than what is a very secondary long-wave service that isn't really aimed at the island of Ireland at all, but is...
Well, the RTE are actually under an obligation from the Broadcasting Act to provide a radio and television service to the diaspora. That's absolutely written into the laws that govern RTE, and I have to say that I believe that it's RTE's duty, not just legally but morally, to serve not just the island of Ireland, but also the Irish in Britain. And incidentally, on the whole issue of the island of Ireland, if they do switch off long-wave transmissions, then large chunks of Belfast and parts of Northern Ireland will not have access to RTE Radio 1 except either by satellite or internet. So on that level, I think they're also shirking their responsibility to listeners on the island of Ireland.
And that was Richard Logue of the Save RTE Longwave 252 campaign speaking to us earlier from London. Well, we asked RTE for a comment or for a spokesperson to comment on this topic, but we didn't receive any response from them. You can learn more about the campaign to maintain the Longwave service at saverte.longwaveradio.com and on social media.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
The first few weeks of Donald Trump's presidency have been chaotic and divisive, and one of the battlegrounds of the next 4 years will be between the new administration and the media. The Trump campaign was endorsed by right-wing radio talk shows and conservative media outlets, but rejected by liberal and radical media ranging from the Washington Post to stations in the progressive Pacifica radio group. The rise of so-called alternative facts and their propagation by powerful media outlets underlines more than ever the need for diversity and accuracy in radio. A campaign called Protect My Public Media has been launched amid fears that Trump will privatise the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and reduce or eliminate federal funding for local public radio and television stations. Community and minority radio stations are thought to be particularly vulnerable. Dr. Andrew O'Buil is a former manager of Flirt FM and now a lecturer in media in the School of Humanities at NUI Galway. He explains why he believes the Trump administration poses a threat to public radio.
The CPB and public media in general have been a long-standing target of the far right and of the right more generally in the US. There've been ongoing episodic attempts to cut back or eliminate funding to various not just of the CPB but also of other cultural institutions, the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and so on. Now, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is a private, not-for-profit corporation which was established by Congress and which is funded by congressional appropriation. It then provides grants that support public radio and public television in the U.S. And so if you cut off funding to the CPB, to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, you cut off downstream funding for a lot of other things. As here, public broadcasting, and public broadcasting is the U.S. term for what here we term public service broadcasting, but also there's a lot of overlap with community radio, with community media and other organizations, as well as minority radio like tribal radio and so on. If you cut off these funding, there are a number of things that the CPB funds that will... there's a dual funding system, so you're not only reliant on congressional funding, but you also have sponsorship. You've got private philanthropy, but private philanthropists they fund specific things. When people give you large sums of private funds, they're often interested in particular types of content, or they've got specifications that are narrower and that don't cover the range of what public radio and public broadcasting does. One of the things that the CPB does is it provides grant support for radio stations in areas where they are the only media outlet. There's a lot of the US which is sparsely populated rural areas, and large sparsely populated rural areas, where it does not make economic sense to set up a commercial media outlet. And so those areas are reliant on heavily government subsidized by way of the CPB radio stations. A lot of these are in Native American reservations. A lot of them are in the far west in rural areas, and these are areas that if they do not have federal support, they cannot run their transmitters. It doesn't make economic sense to fund the staff to run the studio, to have a studio to run these things. And you are not going to easily access philanthropic funds to say, well, we are this population of 10,000 people spread out over 1,000 square miles or whatever it might be. And so a lot of truly rural America, not kind of this urban-rural split that people talk about in terms of kind of cities and out of the cities, but areas that are remote, that are fragmented away from the rest of the country geographically, will lose what are really lifelines of community-based, of locally-based programming. So they will have no broadcast outlets other than the possibility of getting in satellite television, which is, of course, expensive. There's a lot of research done, particularly in Canada, around just the challenges of reaching rural populations and the difference between satellite feeds and the terrestrial channels that, that the sort of funding supports. So that's something that we're going to see under threat. One of the other things that, that the CPB does is it subsidizes content. Now, a lot of this is done by way of providing grants to radio stations, to individual radio stations, to buy in syndicated content. This is the way that they kind of have a multi-step process where local stations get to make their programming decisions, but then get CPB funding to subsidize their purchase of content that is not commercially available or that would not survive in a commercial marketplace. Some of those things will continue to thrive. So NPR's the national content originator, some of their big programs like All Things Considered already have significant commercial sponsorship and have commercial sponsorship from organizations that are well connected with the Trump cabinet, ExxonMobil and so on. So they'll continue to get funding, but there have been questions raised around the influence of commercial entities in public radio when you're reliant on this philanthropic money. The Koch brothers, who are the paymasters of a lot of the right-wing philanthropy that is attempting to recast the US, sit on the boards, are major funders of various of the public radio institutions in New York and elsewhere, but do so with certain caveats in terms of their own commercial interests, what sort of stuff they'll support, what sort of stuff. Then there's something of a chilling effect for media outlets, for journalists, when they know that we are reliant on these big money donors who have expressed their disagreement with their lack of belief in climate change or their desire that climate change not be discussed. And so if you're reliant on ExxonMobil, are you going to suddenly say, hey, we took that money we got from Exxon and we're running a multi-week, you know, every day we're going to spend 15 minutes talking about climate change? That's less likely to happen. And so you're going to see a chilling effect. You're going to see certain types of content changed in those stations that do secure funding. The other thing you're going to see is that there's certain types of content that is currently subsidized by way of these CPB subsidies that just won't attract philanthropic dollars. Programs that are politically radical, programs that are aimed at minority populations, programs that are aimed at linguistic minorities that aren't necessarily economically well-to-do and so aren't attractive in terms of underwriting and sponsorship and getting your name in front of audiences. And so we'll see a thinning out of the cultural landscape in terms of the sorts of supports that are available for linguistic minorities, for ethnic minorities across the US. And that's something that's just going to as they thin out, denude the public culture. And this is part of the goal. The stated claim is that, you know, we're going to cut the federal budget by getting rid of the National Endowment for the Arts and CPB. But if you look at the size of funding for these things, it's hundreds of millions. It's, you know, in Irish terms, it'll be a lot of money. But you're talking about federal budgets of over 10 trillion. Over a trillion. 10 trillion on a multi-year basis. And so you're looking at budgets that just are... These are drops in the bucket. It's not going. This isn't making a bottom line difference to the U.S. deficit. What it is doing is it's having an overwhelming impact on public culture, cultural creation that is outside the reach of market forces, outside the reach of philanthropic groups. The large foundations run by people like the Koch brothers.
Of course, that's where the opposition would come from, is from this precise place.
Exactly. And so what you're doing is this is also it's of a piece with attempts to to get rid of in the workforce, get rid of what's known as fair share. In the US, by law, labor unions need to represent all workers in a workplace, or in what's known as a bargaining unit. Anybody who is in a certain type of role in an organization needs to be represented. A union needs to provide resources, whether or not the person is a member of a union. And so in most in many states historically, there was kind of a quid pro quo. Well, if we're required to represent all workers, we can get all workers to contribute a fee towards the representation fee to cover the costs of bargaining to improve their conditions and representing them, not to cover political activities and so on by the organization, but to cover those costs of actually being a union. What we see roll out across the U.S. There's an attempt. There's talk of an attempt of a federal work or a right to work rule, and a right to work rule is one that bans agency fees, bans representation fees by unions, which means that only people who sign up to pay the fee contribute to the union, but without getting rid of the other side of the bargain, which is continuing to require that unions represent all workers, even if they don't, if they're not paying into the pot. That what that does is, when you look at the large financial forces on the left in the U.S., labor unions are it. Contributions coming from individual members, from individual workplaces, are what provide the bulk of funding for cultural activism, for political activism on the center left of the Democrat to the Democratic Party and so on. So you either you've got, you know, maybe some of the major billionaire or multimillionaire donors will continue to be able to fund, but the large donors, if you look at somebody like Bernie Sanders, top 10 donors to him, I think 9 of them were labor unions. Those labor unions, if there's a right to work rule, and they no longer they can, it becomes unviable to represent workers, and you get rid of the union sector. You therefore get rid of the possibility of having organized funding. When I was on the county labor board in Champaign County, one of the major things that we did was we subsidized food deliveries to essentially soup kitchens and the like, and that was something that was only possible because you had labor unions that were established across the university and across the city, and that we had those funding sources available to us that allowed us to support our broader community. And those sorts of things, those sorts of supports are going to disappear. It's going to be a meaner US. It's going to be one in which people are going to be turned against each other, in which you are not going to have those either cultural or political organizations that pull people together to help them engage with each other. And that's the goal. We're not going to see literal Hunger Games, but this notion of seeing, this is Trump's vision of the world, is of self-interested entities fighting with each other for dominance and primacy. And he believes he's top dog, and he thinks, well, then he can, you know, kick downward. But he thinks that's, why doesn't everyone else kick downward and pull them, you know, climb up the pile of corpses that surrounds them?
And community media is part of the challenge to that. That will suffer as a result.
Exactly. There's, you know, this. I use the word swarm to describe some of the microtransmitters. You're seeing, and you've had that used as activism against commercial media at NAB in the early 2000s. This notion of actual swarms of transmitters. But that's community media provides this kind of dispersed network of opportunities for cultural engagement, for education, for engagement, for participation, for reflection, and that sort of those sorts of spaces are going to be decimated, and therefore, yeah, ensure that you limit the opportunities for people to engage in political discussion to engage in building alternatives to these dominant forces.
And that was Dr. Andrew O'Buil of the School of Humanities here in NUI Galway discussing fears that public and community radio will suffer under the Trump administration.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
Across Ireland, it is estimated that 2,000 volunteers participate in community radio every week in 21 licensed stations and almost 30 aspirant stations. Their representative body is CRAIL, also known as the Community Radio Forum of Ireland. As well as representing and coordinating the sector, CRAIL also lobbies for its interests and provides training and support services. But as part of the voluntary not-for-profit sector, community radio faces many challenges. Martina O'Brien is project coordinator of CRAIL.
Well, CRAIL has existed since the early 90s in some shape or form. Basically came about when the then Broadcasting Commission of Ireland, or IRTC, basically commissioned a new type of broadcasting legislation for community radios to exist. So I suppose they were unsure what they'd call themselves, but they were basically to try and get the sector up and running and to be legalised, because a lot of people back in the 90s who would have been involved in community would basically have been pirate radios. So they came together, a group of people, at Jack Byrne, who is still a very important member of CRAIL at the moment, and a lot of different people from around the country came together and decided to, I suppose, lobby the now Broadcasting Commission, or Authority of Ireland, to, I suppose, get recognition for the sector, start getting licences for the sector, and then to develop the sector. And so that's kind of what CRAIL would work alongside the BAI to do. So things like development, so new stations coming online, supporting those stations, and also just being there as a lobbyist and a communications body for all the stations in Ireland.
Because there was a delay in the setup of community radio, wasn't there? So presumably CRAIL, the bones of CRAIL came together then around the mid-90s, would that be correct?
Yeah, so between the legislation coming about and the actual licences has been issued, there was a couple of years, and it was in 2001 when, I suppose, CRAIL, the cooperative body, was actually formed. The delay, I suppose, it's like anything when new legislation comes in, it just takes a while for things to, new application forms, people who understand and can work in the sector, that kind of thing. So that took was very slow to roll out, but eventually it did. So we had stations like Flirt FM, we had Wired FM, Radio Nalifa, Near FM. There's a lot of stations still in existence today and are quite strong. And these would all have been the very first stations to come on air back in, I think, Flirt just celebrated its 21st birthday in the last year or so. So you're talking 22 years now, which is great to think that it's lasted that long, and hopefully will for many, many more.
And what kind of daily activities or general ongoing activities does CRAIL engage in then when it comes to supporting community radio in Ireland?
Okay, well, myself, I work the, I suppose, help desk is what we like to call it. So that would range from anything from an email to a phone conversation to an actual station visit, where I would speak to the station representatives, whether it be the station manager, the chairperson, or the board members of the particular station, or indeed a volunteer may get in contact with me. The queries can range in anything from, I suppose, help with a funding application. CRAIL itself runs a shared resource programme whereby stations come together and share successful applications, where it be for the Sound and Vision scheme that the BAI run to, I suppose, produce special radio broadcasting programmes, or it could be something as simple as a local partnership application to get funding. We, I suppose, share these with other stations then. You basically share something with us, and then we'll give you something back in return. It's a really, really positive initiative that we've been running now successfully for the last, I'd say, nearly 7 or 8 years. We'd also do it in terms of programme sharing. At the moment, we're in a big change in that we've changed our website. So as you can imagine, if we were to share programmes, there'd be a massive amount of storage needed. So this is becoming too tall an order for us to do. So we're now going to look at changing the way we do that. But it does intend to go that way. So as I said, they could be simply querying something about an application, or it could be that they're just finding it difficult to maintain volunteers or to keep them interested. It really does vary from day to day, and that's where I come in on a daily basis and I suppose help that. And on another level then, we have the committee. So the committee is 9 members of 9 different stations around the country, and they come together once a month and I suppose look at the bigger picture about where CREAL is, and they would negotiate with the BAI for funding, which helps CREAL exist. So again, we'd run training on a monthly basis on various different topics that our membered stations need. And then obviously we'd review that and double check that, I suppose, that's what the stations wanted or needed, and that it's of some benefit for them. And then if it's needed again next year, we would do that. So we have a very successful FELA, which runs at the moment at the end of May every year. And this is where all the stations come together and we basically run workshops, anything from how to get on air, so for the new aspirant stations who are hoping to finally get that temporary licence, or to something technical like how to do an outside broadcast. So we're very big on, I suppose, teaching each other rather than bringing in too many outsiders, as we like to say sometimes, to develop our skills, because we're all in the same line of work. So it's easier to, I suppose, correspond and explain things in our own language, if that even makes sense. But sometimes it's different in the commercial sector. So we would definitely bring in commercial people because obviously they have lots of skills to share too. But it is nice to be able to say that we train ourselves and develop ourselves.
And what kind of programmes have been shared in the past? You mentioned the programme sharing facility. So what does that entail?
So it basically is any type of programme you feel would be appropriate to share in any other station. So you have to think about it in logistical terms, whether the once the programme is broadcast, is it worth broadcasting again? So I suppose, does it go out of date very quickly? Is it something that, if you're talking in local area terms, would it really be suitable to broadcast? So, I mean, if it's a historical kind of program, or if it's just an interesting story, because a lot of the best stories really could come out of good programming, like the Sound of Vision scheme, where you'd, I suppose, highlight somebody's experience or people's experience in an area, and that can be shared across any demographic area. So they're the type of shows. So we ask stations, if they are to upload, that they would, I suppose, give a brief outline to stations about what the programme entails, how long it is, who was involved in making the programme, that kind of thing. So it's then up to the stations themselves, as they read this content, whether they feel it's appropriate for them to broadcast it.
And you mentioned as well the possibly advice that you give to new and upcoming stations. What is the nature of that advice, and what would you say to anybody who's maybe thinking about setting up their own community radio station?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, I've been a manager and I've gone through the whole, I've been a volunteer, a studio executive, a manager, and now I work for CREAL. So I've seen the benefits of every side of a station can have. So it was massively influential in my life. But the thing is, with starting up a new community radio station, is it a long, slow process? You need a good committee team behind you. It can't be 2 or 3 people doing it. They'll just burn out and lose interest. So if they come to me and they want to, I suppose, begin the task of trying to set up a radio station, first off, I would point them to our website, where we have the development ladder, and there's 4 steps to the development ladder. It's a PDF document that anyone is free to download on our website, and it explains the different stages of, I suppose, trying to get on air, whether it be temporary or full licence. So this is a checklist nearly of what you should do before you can move on to the next step. So it outlines things like what type of organisation you want to become. So we have 2 main ones, which are a co-op or a limited company. Explains all that difference in it. Basically, it emphasises as well what makes a community radio station rather than a local commercial station, which is unfortunately what we get confused with an awful lot of the time. So a community station is owned by the community. There's no necessary need for advertising on the station, so therefore there's no agendas seeking airtime or whatever. It is literally about the people within that demographic or special interest group who want to broadcast about their special interest group and life and experiences and all that. So it's a big task. It sounds great, but it is a slow process. As I said, the team behind you is great, and then it's also keeping contact with me, because, or even individual CREAL representatives, because you never know what else information you could find out. Sometimes it's at the tip of your tongue to ask that question, and in a conversation about something else it comes up. So it really is an enjoyable experience, a rewarding experience, when you can see somebody who comes in, never had any idea of radio, how to make a programme, and about 6 weeks to maybe 6 months later, they're fully fledged, off on the air, no bothers them, they're able to make a programme and broadcast to the local area. So it's really rewarding. And I suppose it's the people themselves in the areas broadcasting to their own people. And that's really important. And you don't get that in commercial stations as much.
And yes, can you describe the community radio sector then in Ireland at the moment? What are the, who are the leading players in it, and what does the landscape of community radio in Ireland look like?
Well, there is 20 fully licensed stations at the moment, and we've probably got about another 20 to 30 aspirants at various different stages. So this involves people on a 100-day license, 30-day licenses, or people who are just trying to get those temporary licenses. I wouldn't like to pinpoint any station out as being the leader, but there are some really strong ones, because I suppose they have a really good team behind them. And you may find in 2 years that a different station is the one. It's like any organisation, it goes through peaks and troughs. You've got quite a few here in the west of Ireland. So you've Carrickbar, Clare Morris, you've got Eris FM, which is in Belmullet, which is a temporary licence. You've got Connemara, Flirt FM, and we also have one aspirant that I can think of the top of my head in Kinvara, where they're trying to seek a 30-day licence at the moment. So there's a lot of different areas around that you could benefit from the stations. There's also Ross FM. If I start naming them all now, they'd be given out that I didn't get mentioned another, but there's a lot of diversity on the radio stations. So depending on, I suppose, the immigrants that come into the areas, they may influence the station, and someone, you know, share their experiences, speak to the people that have immigrated from different parts of the world in their local towns. So there'll be a heavy enough population of Polish in Clare Morris. So, you know, they have some Polish programming. So you try and reflect who's living in your area and who wants to listen to you. It's really interesting. Yes, so there's about 14 stations at the moment who actually are funded through Publin. What this means is that they have full-time staff members who are basically able to run the stations for the areas. So Publin comes through the government, but also some EU departments. And the money that is involved in Publin is so, so important for stations to exist and to continue. So they might fund the manager, and in some cases 2 to 4 full-time equivalents, which is just full-time employees, and they can range. It's up to the station when they put in and submit a business plan as to what these people do. So it could be something like going out and doing community outreach, a volunteer coordinator, a technical person, or a sales person. It really is up to the stations, but that, without that money, it'll be so difficult for most of the stations to exist, and I suppose to develop, because if you're constantly, I suppose, redrawing or redesigning your day-to-day running, it's very hard to, I suppose, develop. So that station, it means there's continuity and development in each station that they have a public member.
And is funding then the biggest challenge facing the community radio sector? It's obviously very underfunded in general.
Yeah, no, definitely. Funding would be, like any, I suppose, non-profit organisation, is the big problem that we would love to, I suppose, solve. So stations would get primarily their funding from things like Publin, or if they have their own organisation that's tied to it. So the colleges, for instance, would get fees to, I suppose, a small fee from the capitation fees in each college. So you've got Cork Campus Radio, Flirt FM and Word FM. So Flirt is in Galway and Word FM is in Limerick. And the small capitation fees go towards the manager's wage and maybe, I suppose, the running costs of the stations. So if you think of any developments, new equipment, a lot of fundraising needs to take place. So fundraising would be a massive part of most stations. Advertising to a lesser extent, because some people don't like the fact that they want to bring in this advertising. It kind of, I suppose, messes somewhat with their ethos, because you don't want, if you're putting an advertisement for a company on and they may not like the program that's coming up next, you know, it can, I suppose,
create tensions.
Absolutely. So I think going forward, we'd like to see no need for the advertising. And it also helps then the local commercials to, I suppose, feel more easy with community radio stations, because there can be a little bit of tension. When we all started to roll out, I suppose it became a bit more of a problem that, you know, we may be treading on someone else's territory for the advertising. Now, thankfully, we've a great relationship with them, but, you know, when times are tough, you begin to see the cracks, and you kind of go, oh, where can this go? So we've been trying to lobby the government to look at other alternative funding streams. So there's a lot of models around Europe. Ireland has a great, community radio sector, and it's developed very well when you compare it to other countries in Europe. But saying that, other countries use the funding, the EU funding that the Sound and Vision Scheme comes for core funding for community radio stations, and I suppose that's what we would like to see. If we got a couple of grand a year, which was guaranteed insofar as obviously you use the funds wisely, but it's money that you can guarantee that's going to be there every year. It just makes life so much easier. You can start to plan longer term than year to year, or in some cases month to month in some stations.
There's very little core funding at the moment.
There's no core funding whatsoever. It's literally up. Every station is different. So Flirt has the capitation fees, as I said, but another station might be primarily on advertising and training.
That was Martina O'Brien of the Community Radio Forum, CRAIL, and you can read more about CRAIL and the community radio sector at crail.ie. And finally, some other radio news in brief. The latest JNLR Ipsos MRBI report into radio listening was launched last Thursday, the 2nd of February. Based on the 12-month period from January 2016 to January 2017, it found that 82% of adults reported that they listened to radio every day. The numbers were lower among a younger age cohort, with 76% of 15 to 34 year olds stating that they were daily listeners. National radio holds the majority position in Dublin, and local radio is strongest elsewhere. The alternative music radio station 8radio.com went on air last Saturday for the first of 8 weekends on FM in February and March. 8 Radio broadcasts online normally, but is now available on FM on a temporary multi-city licence every Saturday and Sunday in Dublin, Cork, Limerick and Galway. And you'll be able to listen now on in Galway on 87.7 FM, as well as the usual 8radio.com. The Social Democrats have launched an initiative to highlight the importance of media plurality in Ireland. This coming Wednesday, February the 8th, Deputy Catherine Murphy will initiate a private members bill to protect the diversity of ownership and address the issue of control of media in Ireland. In Australia, there has been criticism of the decision of public broadcaster ABC to cease its shortwave services to the Northern Territory at the end of January. Remote rural communities in the bush have complained that they're unable to receive broadcasts on medium wave and FM, and that digital content will be inaccessible. And finally, World Radio Day, a worldwide celebration of radio as a medium organised by UNESCO, takes place next Monday, February the 13th. And that brings us to the end of this month's edition of Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. We'll be back on the first Monday in March with more news from the radio world, including an interview with our very own station manager Paula Healy. I do hope you'll join us then, but in the meantime you can follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt and on facebook.com/wirelessflirt. There's also a blog accompanying the programme, wirelessflirt.wordpress.com. Until the next edition of Wireless, this is John Walsh wishing you all good listening.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.